Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Namibian official takes aim at gays and lesbians, U.S. vice presidential candidates take non-stands on marriage rights, and a gay ensemble drama takes a slice of West Hollywood life to the silver screen. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Chase Schulte.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 7th, 2000. Namibia's Home Affairs Minister Jerry Akanjo called on 700 new graduates of the police academy to eliminate gays and lesbians. Asserting that the Constitution does not guarantee rights for gays and lesbians, he said, "We must make sure we eliminate them from the face of Namibia," lumping homosexual acts with all other unnatural acts, including murder. He said, "Even if gays and lesbians had a gay dog, they should murder it." Such anti-gay rhetoric has resurfaced periodically since Namibian President Sam Nujoma first made similar remarks almost 4 years ago. 2 years ago, Akanjo himself demanded harsh anti-gay legislation in an impassioned speech on the floor of the parliament, but that move was blocked by Prime Minister Hage Geingob. Akanjo has been something of a loose cannon on some other issues as well, and the leader of an opposition party, Ketu Utiri Kaura of DTA, said he would call for a vote of no confidence in the coming week to force Akanjo's removal from the cabinet. Namibia's Gay and Lesbian Rainbow Project rejected Akanjo's claim they have no constitutional rights, and in fact they are specifically protected from discrimination under the Labor Code. Rainbow called on the government to publicly reject Akanjo's remarks, but that hasn't happened.
There may soon be a more responsive government for gays and lesbians in Sao Paulo, Brazil's largest city. Marta Suplicy, who was the nation's most outspoken advocate for gays and lesbians during her tenure in Brazil's House of Deputies, was the top vote-getter for Sao Paulo mayor in this week's elections. Although she did not get a majority of the vote and will face a runoff in late October, she had about twice as many votes as her nearest opponents and is expected to win. Most notably, while in the Congress, Suplicy introduced a bill to give gay and lesbian couples most of the legal benefits of marriage, but it was stalled for years by religious opposition. Sao Paulo has the worst crime statistics in the Americas, including a recent resurgence of neo-Nazi groups, particularly targeting gays and lesbians and their allies.
U.S. activists against hate violence suffered a crushing blow this week when a House Senate Conference Committee dropped a Senate rider from a defense spending measure. The amendment would have established what has been known as the Hate Crimes Prevention Act, a measure to add sexual orientation, gender, and disability as protected categories under federal hate crimes law. It would also greatly expand the situations in which federal authorities could investigate and prosecute hate crimes, primarily in support of local authorities. The hate crimes measure has long had the vocal advocacy of President Bill Clinton, has solid majority support in both the House and Senate, and according to polls is favored by about two-thirds of the public. Yet Republican leaders have continued to block its progress. Democrats have vowed to use every possible procedural maneuver to achieve passage before the Congress adjourns later this month. More likely, the measure's future will depend on the outcome of November elections. Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Al Gore supports the bill, while Republican nominee Texas Governor George W. Bush does not believe that bias-motivated crime should be treated differently from others.
The loss of the hate crimes amendment was particularly bitter coming on the heels of the mass shooting in a gay-friendly Roanoke, Virginia bar that left one dead and six injured. The suspect, Ronald Gay, allegedly told a witness beforehand that he was going to waste some fags. This week, a grand jury indicted him on six charges of aggravated malicious wounding and seven firearms charges, which could add 180 years to a possible life sentence for first-degree murder in the death of gay Danny Overstreet. The last of the other six shooting victims has been released from the hospital after almost 2 weeks.
But gay and lesbian activists did have something to celebrate this week, as Dr. Laura Schlesinger's new syndicated TV show was dropped by its Canadian broadcasters. The top-rated radio talk show host's move to the small screen has been vigorously protested all year because of her descriptions of gays and lesbians as deviant, a biological error, abnormal, aberrant, disordered, and dysfunctional, and her assertion that many gay men are pedophiles. Earlier this year, industry watchdog the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council issued a scathing critique against her radio program, calling her abusively discriminatory and breach of the National Broadcasting Code. But none of that had anything to do with the four CanWest Global stations in Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec dropping the show, something no U.S. station has done yet. It was painfully low ratings that led to Schlesinger's Canadian TV demise. Less than 0.5% of households in Ontario and BC, less than 1/3 of what CanWest had anticipated. A corporate spokesperson said, "Essentially, you can't have a show on the air if nobody watches it." Schlesinger's TV show is tanked in U.S. ratings as well, but most of its carriers are bound by contract to continue it.
Schlesinger believes that homosexual orientation can be changed to heterosexual, a belief not shared by the American Psychological Association and other leading professional groups, but one cherished fervently by Exodus International. That umbrella association of conversion programs was profoundly embarrassed when its high-profile ex-gay poster boy John Polk was spotted and photographed in a gay bar last month. Polk had been serving as board chair of Exodus North America, but this week the board removed him as chair and placed him on probationary status. Although technically he will still be listed as a board member, he will not be allowed to vote or even to attend meetings. Just to retain that ceremonial status, he will have to undergo quarterly reviews on criteria which have not been made public. Polk compounded his problems by at first lying to both the board and reporters, claiming he hadn't known it was a gay bar, but was only looking for a bathroom. He soon confessed to the board that he had known it was a gay bar when he went in, but he said he was not looking for sex, and the board believes him. Polk has been employed by religious right media powerhouse Focus on the Family as its manager of homosexuality and gender issues. He still has a job there, but has been suspended from leading its traveling Love One Out seminars.
Britain's opposition Conservative Party held its annual convention this week with high hopes of regaining power in next year's elections. To the astonishment of many, party spokesperson on economic affairs Michael Portillo included in his major address a statement that the party is for all people, whatever their sexual orientation. It was a surprising statement about the party, and even more surprising coming from Portillo. Before his re-entry into politics late last year, he sought to quash rumors by revealing that he had had affairs with men before his entry into public life and marriage. He's hardly spoken publicly on gay and lesbian issues since being returned to Parliament and elevated to his current status on the party's front bench. His remark was in line with Conservative parliamentary leader William Hague's hope of expanding the party's voter base, a hope which led to the appointment of Conservative champion of gay and lesbian rights Stephen Norris as party chair. But Portillo's remark did not elicit applause.
Gerald Howarth, Conservative chair of the Parliament's Family and Child Protection Group, later maintained that the party has always been tolerant of gays and lesbians, while staunchly maintaining his defense of Section 28, that Thatcher-era prohibition against local governments devoting resources to the promotion of homosexuality. Norris fired back that to say the party has always been tolerant of gays and lesbians is naive and downright stupid, and that the party's defense of Section 28 is homophobic nonsense.
At a conference fringe meeting, party spokesperson on foreign affairs Francis Maude said that too many gay people have been put off by the publicity given to our position on Section 28. But he too staunchly supports Section 28. His point was that if we make that case in a way that appears to be more about hostility to homosexuality than about the protection of children, we risk making a significant minority of the population feel that we are simply not for them.
Meanwhile, Section 28's fierce defender in the House of Lords, Janet Young, Baroness of Farnworth, told another conference fringe meeting the party must make a commitment to keeping the clause and to keeping the age of consent for sex between men at 18, rather than matching it with the heterosexual age of consent of 16. She also stated clearly that what she called a single-sex relationship does not constitute a family, which she defines as husband and wife, with or without children.
In winding up the conference, Haig himself made an applause-winning statement of support for Section 28 and showed that he makes no connection between tolerance and policy. In a remark understood to refer specifically to gay and lesbian activists, he said, "Refusing simply to accept every demand from every pressure group is not in contradiction with respecting the differences between individuals. On the contrary, the championing of mainstream values is the championing of tolerance, mutual respect, and the rich diversity of our country."
And finally, the Tory conference was the subject of a particularly hilarious sketch in the London Times by openly gay columnist Matthew Paris. Paris particularly tweaked the party's candidate to represent Henley in Parliament, Boris Johnson, for how often he appears momentarily flustered. As Paris tells it, at one point there was a sort of brainstorming session in which party chair Michael Ancram challenged each speaker to name one brave, unpopular thing William Haig should do. Momentarily flustered, Johnson spluttered, "Wear a dress?"
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 7th, 2000. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chase Schulte.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Coming up later in the program, This Way Out's Steve Pride finds out what it takes to join the Broken Hearts Club, and we'll hear a musical response to the latest attack on gays and lesbians by the Oregon Citizens Alliance. But first, the issue of same-gender marriage got a brief moment in the spotlight of the U.S. presidential campaign on October 5th during the one and only debate between the Democratic and Republican candidates for vice president, Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman and former Defense Secretary Richard Cheney. Lieberman focused on his record of support for gay and lesbian rights, and while having no positive record to cite, Cheney also failed to mention his lesbian daughter, Mary. And neither noted that the question posed by the moderator, CNN's Bernard Shaw, was somewhat broader than the answers they gave.
Senator, sexual orientation. Should a male who loves a male and a female who loves a female have all the constitutional rights enjoyed by every American citizen?
A very current and difficult question, and I've been thinking about it, and I want to explain what my thoughts have been. Maybe I should begin this answer by going back to the beginning of the country and the Declaration of Independence, which says right there at the outset that all of us are created equal, and that we're endowed not by any bunch of politicians or philosophers, but by our Creator with those inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At the beginning of our history, that promise, that ideal, was not realized or experienced by all Americans. But over time since then, we have extended the orbit of that promise. And in our time, at the frontier of that effort is extending those kinds of rights to gay and lesbian Americans who are citizens of this country and children of the same awesome God just as much as any of the rest of us are. That's why I have been an original co-sponsor of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which aims to prevent gay and lesbian Americans who are otherwise qualified from being discriminated against in the workplace. And I've sponsored other pieces of legislation and taken other actions that carry out that ideal. The question you pose is a difficult one for this reason. It confronts or challenges the traditional notion of marriage as being limited to a heterosexual couple, which I support. But I must say I'm thinking about this because I have friends who are in gay and lesbian partnerships who have said to me, isn't it unfair that we don't have similar legal rights to inheritance, to visitation when one of the partners is ill, to health care benefits? And that's why I'm thinking about it, and my mind is open to taking some action that will address those elements of unfairness while respecting the traditional religious and civil institution of marriage.
Mr. Secretary.
This is a tough one, Bernie. Fact of the matter is we live in a free society, and freedom means freedom for everybody. We don't get to choose and shouldn't be able to choose and say you get to live free, but you don't. And I think that means that people should be free to enter into any kind of relationship they want to enter into. It's really no one else's business in terms of trying to regulate or prohibit behavior in that regard. The next step then, of course, is the question you ask of whether or not there ought to be some kind of official sanction, if you will, of the relationship, or if these relationships should be treated the same way a conventional marriage is. That's a tougher problem. That's not a slam dunk. I think the fact of the matter, of course, is that matters regulated by the states. I think different states are likely to come to different conclusions, and that's appropriate. I don't think there should necessarily be a federal policy in this area. I try to be open-minded about it as much as I can, and tolerant of those relationships. And like Joe, I'm also wrestle with the extent to which there ought to be legal sanction of those relationships. I think we ought to do everything we can to tolerate and accommodate whatever kind of relationships people want to enter into.
That was Republican Dick Cheney and Democrat Joe Lieberman during their nationally televised vice presidential candidates debate, seen, according to initial Nielsen ratings reported in the New York Times, by over 28 million viewers.
Hello, I'm Scott Thompson. And when I'm not lounging about on friends' couches, watching pornography and chatting and flipping through magazines, living the gay lifestyle, I'm listening to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
A surprise hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival may finally be coming soon to a theater near you. The entertaining ensemble drama about a group of gay West Hollywood friends was written and directed by Greg Berlanti, one of the producers of TV's popular Dawson's Creek, and boasts a cast of some of Hollywood's hottest young actors. This Way Out's Steve Pride had a chance to chat with Berlanti and two of his stars, Timothy Oliphant of Scream fame and Andrew Keegan from TV's Party of Five, about membership in the Broken Hearts Club.
There's not a single film in the cinema canon that paints a portrait of a gay man that any of us would aspire to be. Can you imagine if they made a film about us, our group of friends?
It boasts an attractive cast that features Timothy Oliphant as Dennis, the group's center and a promising West Hollywood photographer. As he prepares to celebrate his 28th birthday, Dennis laments,
I'm 28 years old and the only thing I'm good at is being gay.
That's not true.
It is true.
Dennis's eclectic crew of pals include Zach Braff as Benji, the innocent youth with spiky hair and a predilection for gym bunnies.
Freaking out. I was in the middle of my squats and he comes over and just gives me these tips. Is that like fate or what? Maybe I should get his number.
No way, little Benjamin. Gym bunnies make a bad name for all of us. Their lives revolve around sex and protein shakes.
Then cat tranquilizers.
If you intend on experiencing the joys of a bitter codependent relationship, it's never going to be with a gym bunny.
Dean Cain as Cole, the charismatic actor who accidentally steals everybody's guy.
So what are the chances of me getting your number?
Sorry, I'm seeing someone.
So was I.
Matt McGrath as Howie, the psychology grad student who thinks too much and lives too little.
Dumb, gorgeous people should not be allowed to use literature when competing in the pickup pool. It's like bald people wearing hats.
Rounding out the crew is Billy Porter as Taylor, the drama queen, Ben Weber as the cynical Patrick, and John Mahoney as Jack, beloved patriarch, softball coach, and part-time drag queen.
Come, ye spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex him here.
Now is not the time for Shakespeare in the living room.
No, of course not. It's getting late. It's only 20 minutes to your next meaningless sexual experience.
And if I'm lucky?
Never if you're really lucky.
Notice how subtly I'm ushering you towards the door.
Yes, notice how subtly I'm ushering you towards a healthier existence.
Into this mix like a lamb to the slaughter stumbles Andrew Keegan as Kevin, the newbie, a young man not quite out of the closet.
My mom mentioned that she made key lime pie. I said, that's great. I love key lime pie, and I'm gay.
I bet she wishes she made apple pie.
With his all-American good looks and radiant smile, it's hard to believe 28-year-old writer-director Greg Berlanti could be behind anything called the Broken Hearts Club. Berlanti is currently the executive producer of the hit TV show Dawson's Creek and is the sort of upbeat, charming guy that most glad moms want their sons to marry. I ask him why he wrote the Broken Hearts Club.
Honestly, to get a job, you know, I'd written 9 scripts between plays and screenplays, and I'd been in Hollywood for 3 years, and I had had some success as a theater writer in college. So I left my last temp job that I had out here and was determined to, I had 2 ideas. One was a big romantic comedy idea, and that I thought, oh my God, I'll sell this for, you know, a lot of money and I'll start working. You know, I was floating into Christmas. Like, I thought, at Christmas I can hit up my grandmother and I can get some more money. You know, you're always banking on some period of time in which you have to sort of create something. And so I sat down, and what came out of me instead was this small little story about this group of friends. And a friend of mine who had read a number of my scripts since college, she read it and said, Greg, you have to finish this. And I don't care if you're not working. Like, finish this thing because maybe it will get you other work. And that was exactly what I did and what I needed to do. And it really started my career.
And how much of the Broken Hearts Club is based on his life?
A significant portion of it. It's not exactly that. The tone of it is, I think, and the nature of the relationships are. And lines and elements. It's hard for me to tell where that line is because I would start to accumulate stories that weren't necessarily true but were based more on truth or came out of something that had kind of happened, and then I had modified it or changed it. And it was really a sort of a culmination of all those things. So it's hard for me to look back. The one that's the most autobiographical is the Howie relationship with Marshall, the pot smoker. I had a relationship that was sort of like that. And it was just funny to me that here I was sort of like, you know, I'd never tried drugs in my life and I was dating somebody who was using them a significant amount of time, and I was more straight-laced that way. And so really it just sort of was born out of that, and then I thought, okay, well then I've got to tell maybe the other elements of this. And this is a story I really haven't told, but there was a day where we were shooting that scene in the car between them, and the truck that was pulling the car turned a corner, and I looked up and I realized I was on the exact street where that man had lived, where we had had that conversation 1,000 times right in Hollywood.
There is always pressure on a neophyte filmmaker to just sell the script and let someone else direct. According to Berlanti,
that's actually what I tried to do. I was finally working as a writer, and I didn't want to jinx that. And, you know, because I come from a Catholic upbringing, that was like, you know, don't ruin it. So it was about 1.5 years after I finally was working. And the producer, to his credit, Mickey Liddell, was really the one who said, you know, I think you're the person for this, and I'll make it if you direct it. And was really persistent and was very convincing and said, look, I've done 5 or 6 of these things. And he stood by my side the whole time after every shot and in every phase of this project, and has really sort of walked me through it. And so every phase of this movie sort of hit a new kind of level. I've said, well, you know, the worst can happen is I can give the script out to people and they won't like it, you know, and then it's the worst that can happen is, you know, you don't get the cast, then you get a good cast, and the worst that can happen is, you know, they'll release it through their video arm that they had originally financed it through and not get a theatrical release. Then they see the dailies and that changes, you know, and then 4 days after we finished it, someone said, well, why don't you cut something together in about 24 hours and we'll get it to Sundance and see what happens, and then we're at the closing premiere at Sundance. So it's every phase has been that kind of, I just keep trying to say the same thing, which is, well, the worst that can happen is this movie will come out and nobody will go see it. And hopefully the same laws that have applied to every other phase of the project will apply to this phase.
A question asked so often it's become cliche, but did Berlanti consider sexuality in casting?
My rule about whether or not they were gay was whether or not they seemed like they could be like one of my friends who happened to be gay, you know? And that was the only rule that sort of kind of applied once they walked in the room.
I gave the last word to the star of the film, Timothy Olyphant, who said of his director,
the only thing that kind of came up was, you know, every now and then we'd act too gay or something. You know, that was kind of, we always made this gay meter joke. Cut, that was just way too gay. Do it again. Less gay. That was Greg's biggest direction, I think, throughout the whole film. Cut, Tim, you're too gay. Be less gay, please. Do it again. Ben Weber, that's too straight. Try to be more gay. Let's do it again. That was it. That was Greg's job when it comes down to it.
This has been Steve Pride. The Broken Hearts Club is a Sony Classics release. Thanks for listening.
Man, I'm feeling lonely. Someone telephone me. It's getting hard to pass my time. Take me out a dancing. Watch me while I'm smiling. Baby, it's a waste of time.
There are four gay-related measures on state ballots in the November 7th U.S. general election. Nevada and Nebraska have initiatives that would ban recognition of same-gender relationships. They'll be voting in Maine on anti-discrimination protections. And in Oregon, there's a proposal to prohibit schools from encouraging, promoting, or sanctioning homosexuality. Yet another measure sponsored by the rabidly anti-gay Oregon Citizens Alliance. Sally Shucklow, a lesbian feminist activist based in Eugene, Oregon, who performs with the group Wimprov, got the okay to record new words to the music of a 41-year-old pop classic by Lieber and Stoller for a musical call to action.
I took my troubles down to Anne and Ruth, some friends of mine who always know the truth. They gave me a button and handed me a sign that said, vote no on ballot measure number 9. I told them that I had a thing for chicks. I've been that way since 1966. They said, then beware, 'cause your rights are on the line, and you'd better vote no on ballot measure number 9. Well, Anne looked at Ruthie and gave her a wink. She said, I've got a sign-up sheet right here by the sink. You can make a difference getting people to think. And suddenly I realized I was the link. I started working every day and night to guarantee that we don't lose our rights. So cough up your money and volunteer your time and tell everybody, vote no on measure 9. That damned OCA wants to make all the rules, but we know the violence their prejudice fuels. The voters of Oregon, hey, we're no fools. We don't believe that bigotry protects our schools. We started working every day and night to guarantee that we don't lose our rights. So cough up your money and volunteer your time and tell everybody, vote no on measure 9. Vote no on measure 9. Vote no on measure 9. Vote no on measure 9.
That was ballot measure number 9, a retelling of the Lieber and Stoller classic Love Potion number 9. Performed by Sally Shucklow and written with her performance group Wimprov in response to the latest ballot attack on gays and lesbians by the seemingly relentless Oregon Citizens Alliance. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Chase Schulte, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, Steve Pride, and Sally Shucklow contributed program material. Juliet performed I Need a Man, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation by Planet Out, from designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com, visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And please be sure to include the call letters of this station. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. For Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening on WMPG Gorham, Maine, C101 Hamilton, Ontario, KUGS Bellingham, Washington, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.